I looked online, and it was not easy to get them. I don't know if you guys have done that or not. I think you can get them. It's just that there's not a lot of them out there. Maybe they'll republish it someday. But also, the material in here is certainly derived from BH discussions, especially the Right Reasons set of essays that Jim does regularly. One of the questions or themes that's, hi Big George, that's been very prominent in the early chapters of the book is, should Christian worship be public, or more specifically, should it be, well, open to unbelievers, or designed to accommodate unbelievers? Questions like that have been dealt with. And as you read this book in the early pages, you have to understand that what Jim is doing is pushing back against a trend. And sometimes when you push back against a trend, it seems like you've gone way too far to the other extreme. What would be the extremes on this question? Well, one extreme might be, do not allow any non-baptized, non-professing Christian to attend worship. That would be one extreme position. Don't let them in. Are you baptized? Are you aligned with Christ as your Savior in all aspects of your life? No? Then you can't come in. You can't come in until you meet those criteria. Sorry. That would be an extreme position. The other extreme position is to say, we want to be so welcoming to those unfamiliar with the gospel, to the pagans, that we design the worship to please them. What would they like? What are some things that would really click in the mind of the average humanist today? We'll design our worship that way, and then they'll come in, and we can present the gospel to them in that setting, and thus we will have succeeded. That would be evangelism. That would be another extreme position. Jim is not against having or even inviting unbelievers to the Christian worship service, but he makes a very strong case that when we have the Christian Lord's Day covenant renewal worship, it's essentially family time, the family of Christ time, private time. If the unbeliever is there and observes things, which they can do, it would be good. He had one sentence where he said it would be good if perhaps a deacon or a church member could explain the liturgy to the person. I think that's being kind. I think we do that here. I think that's a very good approach. Let me just say, though, that we here in this church way back were pretty much on the side of using the Sunday morning worship service, and I wouldn't call it covenant renewal back then. We didn't know what covenant meant. But we used to use that as primary evangelism time. Bring your friends. Bring your lost friends. We're going to have a really entertaining program for them, and we did. I'm kind of ashamed of some of them now, in a way, the way you're ashamed of things that happened in your childhood. Not deeply ashamed. I mean, God understands, we're growing. But like in our narrative that we have on our website about our church's history, it's analogous to a church being like a child growing up. And it's the story of our church growing up. And one of the aspects of that is how you conduct your worship. I mean, we had dancing bears. We had contests, red versus blue, bringing people in. We had guys up at the front during worship have their ties cut off with scissors if they didn't win the red versus blue contest. We had bring a friend, get a free Bible day. Not a bad thing in and of itself. Just very, very far from what Lord's Day covenant renewal worship should be. So this is, I think, the last section that Jim wrestles with this question, and then he goes on to other things. But we'll talk, the subject of our talk today is the privacy of worship. And he deals with Matthew chapter 6 and 1 Corinthians 14. Those are two scriptures that are sometimes used to say, hey, wait a minute, worship should be for those on the outside. Now, I'm gonna just read the opening paragraph of this section. To start with, let me reiterate that I don't believe that unbelievers should be completely forbidden to attend Christian worship, that is, close worship, as we have defined it in earlier theses. At the same time, I see no reason to encourage them to come, since close worship, as we have defined it in, since close worship is not an evangelistic event. It may be, but if so, it's a peripheral outcome. All right. If, however, unbelievers want to come and observe, we have no secrets from them. You know, we're not the Masons. And they are free to do so. If your worship service has grown in richness with lots of singing and chanting of psalms, then it would be good for a deacon or one of the families to sit with visitors, whether believers or not, and guide them in understanding the service. I wanted to read that just so you could get an idea that he's not over the top with this stuff. Matthew, the scriptures in Matthew 6, actually Matthew 5 and 6, you're familiar with these. Part of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works, and glorify your Father which is in heaven." When Jonathan Winthrop and the Massachusetts Bay people founded the colony down there that became Boston, their goal was to create a city on a